Road. AI Magnified, brought to you by Go Loud and proudly sponsored by Fitzgerald Power. Adding value always. FitzgeraldPower.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Thank you for joining us for this, the fourth in this special series of Magnified, AI Magnified or Magnified Plus, whatever it is you want to call it. And we hope that you have been enjoying it and getting a better insight and understanding of the incredible revolution that's taking place because of artificial intelligence and generative artificial intelligence. Over the last three episodes, we hope you've enjoyed the panel discussions that we've had. But today we're doing it a little bit differently because we have two individual interviews for you to enjoy. In a little while, you'll hear from the chairman of IDA Ireland, Fergal O'Rourke. We asked Fergal O'Rourke to join us because we wanted to find out just what it is that IDA Ireland is trying to do to encourage companies to locate in Ireland, with AI being very much part of what they do. But also, as importantly, given the enormous tech sector influence that we have on the Irish economy, what the government and its agency, IDA Ireland, is trying to do to encourage them to stay here and to reinvest in AI, and looking at all the things that we need to do to encourage that investment. Again, I would like to thank our series sponsor, Fitzgerald Power. More than just accountants, Fitzgerald Power is a trusted partner for its clients. The firm is committed to empowering businesses with deeper financial insights, helping them make strategic, informed decisions. And Fitzgerald Power and AIB have also come together for a very special event, the AI Magnified panel event, which is going to take place in association with Fitzgerald Power and AIB on the 14th of November. You can hear from SME leaders on how AI is transforming business operations. Would you like to go there? Well, you can register your interest in getting tickets to attend that event by going to fitzgeraldpower.ie/AI event. So we very much hope that some of you will make the effort to come and join us, and we hope that it certainly will be very, very useful to you and give you a further understanding on top of what we've already done here. Now, I'm delighted that today's first guest is Kieran McCrory, who has nearly 35 years' experience in the technology and industry and is currently the National Technology Officer for Microsoft Ireland. Kieran, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. What's involved in the job of a National Technology Officer?
Well, it's a little bit different every day, Matt, to start with. Thanks for having me, by the way. I suppose my job is very much about representing Microsoft on the Irish stage, being a kind of spokesperson for Microsoft in terms of what we do as a digitally transformative company. I work with government a lot. I work with public sector a lot. I work across the regulated industries. Have historically spent a lot of my time talking about data protection and privacy and the use of cloud and security. But I suppose one of the reasons we're here today, the last 18 months has just been pretty much completely dominated by AI and generative AI in particular. So it's funny, it's a strange job in the sense that very often in Microsoft, people change their jobs every few years, but national technology officers tend to stick at it for quite a while. So I've been in role 7 years now. Because the technology landscape changed so quickly, it's almost a new job every quarter.
Microsoft, one of the world's biggest companies, has made a major shift in its business emphasis previously. We once would have known it for PC operating systems where it was so dominant. Then it moved to cloud computing. Is it now making another transition to AI?
It's making a transition to AI, but it's more of a natural evolution, I think, as well. I mean, I think you're right. Historically, we could have been viewed as a product company. We're now a platform company. And that, I suppose, portfolio of offerings on the platform increases as every week, every month goes by.
Can you just explain to me what you mean by a platform company?
So, it's very much focused on, we provide services to our customers. So we're not selling products anymore as such. We're selling services almost exclusively Hyperscale cloud-based services. So this could be data storage, it could be data processing, it could be analytics for data. And we've added to that now with a set of AI services. So these, some of these are, I suppose, out-of-the-box type services, if you want to think of it that way, that someone can purchase and consume. But there are also platform services which enable people, customers, other downstream providers to build their own products and services on top of. So that's what I mean by platform. And cloud-based platform at that, right?
Tell me, though, about the transition in Microsoft towards using AI itself and offering AI to customers.
Yeah. We live and breathe AI in Microsoft every day. I used to work for a company years ago, and their motto used to be, sell what you use, use what you sell. And that's very much what we have in Microsoft today. So AI is pretty much at the heart of our whole suite of products and services that we offer. Copilot being the most obvious example, and Copilot comes in many forms. Our customers are using Copilot, and we use Copilot. We use exactly the same tools, the same Copilots, the same services that our customers use. So we use it on a daily basis.
Again, I don't want to make assumptions that everybody knows what Copilot is. So can you describe it for me, please?
Sure. So Copilot is essentially the embedding of AI into our products like Teams, for example, or Word or PowerPoint. So hopefully people might be familiar with Teams in terms of video conferencing and meetings. The Copilot in Teams, for example, can analyze the proceedings of a meeting and at the end of it come up with a set of notes from that meeting, identify...
God, that's great, because one of the worst jobs ever at a meeting is to be the note taker.
Absolutely, yeah. And you miss things, right? That's a good example of Copilot in Teams. It takes the notes, it identifies actions. If you join a meeting late, for example, you can say, what did I miss in the first 10 minutes? And it will summarize the content of the meeting up to that point for you. And a similar, embedded experience with Copilot in Word, for example. You might need to write a document about something. You've got that classic blank page syndrome. How do I get started? So you just put a prompt. Maybe we'll talk about prompts later. You put a prompt into Copilot. Basically, I need to write a document about an upcoming interview with Matt Cooper, for example. What are the things that I should focus on? And it'll come up and with a list of topics that you might want.
So doing your thinking for you.
It's helping you with your thinking, right? And we're very clear about this, that, and we're very clear with the intent of the name, that it's Copilot, it's not Autopilot. It's not meant to be there to replace the work that you do. It's meant to be there to augment your capabilities and help you in terms of efficiency and productivity. I was talking to someone yesterday, and she was telling me about an example that she uses for the use of AI across the business that she works in, and she described it as one of these e-bikes, right? You're still a cyclist. You're still on the bike. You're in control of the bike. You're riding the bike. Every decision that you make is your decision. It's not the battery's decision. But, when you need to go up a steep hill, the e-bike componentry, the Copilot, kind of helps you get there. So when you get to the crest of the hill, you're not absolutely exhausted. You can just sort of sit back and enjoy the view a little bit more. So that's the way we like to think of Copilot, as being an assistive, enhancing, augmentive technology, not a replacement technology.
Okay, just a couple of things, just on the example of a Teams meeting, yeah. And say, for example, a board meeting or something like that. And this doesn't just apply to companies, it might be voluntary organizations, because often the notes of the meetings become highly disputed. Yeah. But often it can be a good way of leaving things out, that you can sort of have a discussion, but then you agree as to what the actual findings were. Could this be a way of forcing bodies to perhaps be more honest about the discussions that have taken place than perhaps they might want?
Well, I don't think Copilot is going to be an arbiter of the truth or anything like that.
No, but if it just records everything that's happened, which sometimes people like to sort of sketch over.
It'll record and provide insights. And, it's up to you to determine what you do with the content and the output that it provides at the end of the day. It's no substitute for good governance.
Privacy, though, is another issue because an awful lot of companies in particular are paranoid about the idea of information leaking out. And I am aware of businesses which sweep boardrooms before they actually have board meetings. But yet, if you were to have a meeting which was recorded as such by Copilot, does that not mean that your information is going to the cloud where somebody else might be able to access it?
I am so glad you brought this question up because it's one of the biggest, I suppose, areas of concern and misconceptions that we hear from customers all of the time. And I think there is a perception out there that when people are using certainly consumer-grade services like ChatGPT, for example, that these systems are learning all the time. So if I enter some sensitive information, it somehow gets absorbed into the grand corpus of knowledge in ChatGPT. And if another person comes along 20 minutes later and asks a question, somehow that information will be released. So a couple of things I would say. That is not the way that these systems operate on the grand scale. They're trained in you know, one-off activities. The training for these systems takes an exceptionally long amount of time. GPT-4, for example, from OpenAI, it took over a month to train. It costs an enormous amount of money. And so they're trained and then fine-tuned in incremental steps. They don't absorb data as they go along. So that's looking at the broader scale. In terms of, so you gave the example of using Teams to record the minutes or the proceedings of a meeting. That information, I mean, the model doesn't learn from that. The contents of that are not reinvested, as it were, back into the model for someone else to come back and query. So the model doesn't learn from it. Now, the output may well be stored somewhere within your environment. You might store it in your mailbox. You might store it in your OneDrive. You might store it in SharePoint. So it potentially becomes discoverable to other people, but only if they have the right to access that information. So I suppose, you know, one way that you need to look at it is that things like Copilot and Gen AI in general, they're not creating any new security risks or opportunities for people to get information that they shouldn't get to. They're exposing bad practice in the first instance. So it's really important that any organizations looking to deploy this kind of technology make sure they've got good data governance in place from the get-go.
What if malign actors are programming the large language models?
What do you mean by
that? Well, it's that if they have control and what it is, that if they're malign intent in relation to what information they put into it or try and extract from it.
Yeah, so this is often called hijacking in terms of systems. Well, there's a couple of things that you would want to think about there. A, you use large language models from reputable providers that have the right controls in place. So these would be language models from Microsoft, for example, or any of the other myriad, you know, mainline operators out there. There is no doubt that there are malicious actors, nefarious actors that are looking to use the power of LLMs to do bad things. We see it especially in the cybersecurity space and, you know, cyber criminal activity. But I would say that, you know, the main players in this space, whether it's Microsoft, whether it's Google, whether it's Anthropic, whether it's OpenAI, for example, you know, they've got appropriate controls in place to make sure that those large language models are protected from that kind of nefarious upstream activity.
Tell me a little bit about the scale of the Microsoft investment in AI globally. We'll get to Ireland a little while, but tell us about the global scale of, because Microsoft are committing enormous sums of money to this.
So it's complicated, right? And as they say in the news, Matt, it's a rapidly evolving situation, right? So Microsoft has, I think this is a matter of public record, Microsoft has invested in the region of $13.5 billion.
Is that all?
With OpenAI, a mere small amount over the last number of years, and a significant amount of money, right? A lot of that is in terms of access to our cloud platform. When you use ChatGPT or you're using any of the OpenAI services, it's running on the Microsoft Azure cloud, right? So we've made a significant investment with OpenAI over the last number of years because we saw the potential with that company to to massively change, I suppose, the state of the art. So they're using our platform. We use, so I talked about Copilot, for example, which is an AI, a set of AI agents. That's really the GPT LLMs, large language models, behind the covers. So our Copilot technology is built on OpenAI technology. So they're a very, very close partner of ours and have been for the last couple of years and continue to be. I suppose, you know, you'll have noticed in the press over the last weeks or months, OpenAI have embarked on a new funding round. I think they're raising in the region of $6 billion. We've contributed to that amongst other funders as well. So it's and OpenAI also are looking at making their products available to other companies like Apple is the obvious one there. It's a very close partnership.
But it's not all that Microsoft is doing, is it? I mean, you're doing your own independent investments in AI.
Absolutely, right. So, we saw the potential with OpenAI as a real game changer, and we saw how advanced they were. But Microsoft research or Microsoft R&D has been working on LLMs for quite some amount of time, even in advance of this. So, yeah, we have our own large language models, and interestingly, at the moment, there is an interest not just within Microsoft, but more broadly amongst tech companies, not necessarily a move away, but a complementary move to these so-called SLMs or small language models. So these are models that are maybe a little bit more focused in terms of the domains and the areas. The LLMs and ChatGPT, they're broad foundational models. They can answer questions about almost anything because they've been trained on everything. So we now have this phenomenon of small language models or SLMs that maybe only know something about healthcare, for example, or they know something about tourism. So they're much more focused in terms of what they've been trained on and what they can respond to, and much more efficient in terms of the amount of processing power, A, to train, and B, to provide inferences. And they, you know, when you use things like ChatGPT or even Copilot, you're basically talking to a big, large language model in the cloud somewhere. These small language models can exist on mobile devices, on your laptop or on a mobile phone, for example.
And what about Ireland? Where does Ireland fit in with what Microsoft is doing globally?
Well, we have a significant presence here in Ireland, as you may know. Right across the island, actually, our main establishment with respect to staff numbers is in Dublin. So we've, I think, about 3,500 people that work in Microsoft in the south. We have about 150 people, actually, that work for Microsoft in Belfast, doing a variety of different things. What I would say in terms of Microsoft's focus in Ireland with respect to AI is that we have a significant engineering presence here in Dublin, and we have a lot of our engineering teams that are working on some of the features that historically you have seen in the office products like Word and Excel and Outlook and things like that. But we have engineering teams now working on Microsoft Copilot, so they're writing some of the code for how that service operates.
Microsoft also has made significant investment in data centers mm-hmm. in Ireland and has been very committed to purchasing in environmentally sound produced energy and doing that. I think you've been a major investor in wind farms, for example, buying the supply from those. But are you going to have enough data center capacity, given that something that has come up a couple of times previously on this series is the energy hungry nature of AI?
So Microsoft has been in Ireland almost 40 years. In fact, we'll be celebrating our 40th anniversary next year, 50th anniversary of the company. And actually, the Irish data centers were some of the first data centers to be established outside the United States when they first came on stream here quite a few years ago. I don't see this current trajectory of Gen AI decreasing anytime soon. You mentioned I've been in the industry almost 35 years. I say this quite a lot. I've never seen anything move so fast in those almost 35 years of my career as I've witnessed over the last 18 months with generative AI. So there is an upward trajectory in terms of its adoption and its usage. Like I said, for the vast majority of this kind of usage, it's powered through data centers. We have a significant data center presence here in Ireland. We have plans to grow that, as does pretty much everyone.
If you're allowed.
I'm hopeful that we'll see the right set of circumstances come in to play for that, right? I think this is a problem for everyone that in the tech space has a data center presence. Thank you for mentioning our commitment to renewable energy. You know, about a year ago, we announced 900 megawatts of renewable energy from wind farms through these so-called CPPAs or corporate power purchase agreements. You may have seen in the news just recently another 15-year commitment with solar power from a number of solar power farms in Ireland. And you may also know that we just recently launched a green hydrogen project to power some of our data centers in conjunction with ESB. So, of course, power is the fuel for these data centers. And there's another thing I would mention as well. There are two things that you need to think about. There's the power consumption and there's the water consumption, right? And both of these are very, very important. So we've made commitments not too long ago to be carbon negative by 2025. Actually, by 2030, to have removed all of the carbon we've ever been responsible for creating since the company's inception in 1975, and also to be water positive by 2025. So we're on that journey. It's a difficult one. It has become more difficult with the coming of generative AI, and it is power hungry, but we're seeing rapid advancements in the technology here. You know, the latest chips that power this generative AI revolution are becoming increasingly more efficient. We're seeing process node sizes move from 7 nanometers to 5 nanometers to 3 nanometers. What does that mean? It means you can fit more transistors and components onto a single chip. It means that you can get more productivity out of those chips for either the same energy usage or the chips themselves are becoming more energy efficient.
And that's very encouraging. But given the pace at which things are changing, is it possible that the development of generative AI will be retarded by the lack of available energy? And that's not just an Irish issue, a global issue.
I don't think so. I think the technology industry has always found a way to provide the right operating environment for the advancement of technology. Maybe it's self-serving or self-preserving in some way. There are certainly constraints around it, but I see no indications at the moment that, you know, we're going to be bounded by energy constraints. I think both the technology industry and the energy industry and the whole renewable and recyclable industry will find a way to enable this growth, because it's actually in society's interest. I mean, there's hardly a week goes by that you don't pick up one of the industry magazines or a scientific journal and you see some advance in terms of new antibiotics that have been discovered solely through the scientific power of generative AI. Satya Nadella, our CEO, is on record saying last year Microsoft's goal is to compress the next 250 years of chemistry into the next 25 years. And it's only possible by using generative AI. So there's a lot resting on this. So I don't think we're going to be too constrained. It's my personal view, but I think that's how it will kind of sit out.
Although very publicly, Microsoft has committed to nuclear energy in the United States, yes. Power generation via nuclear to power. Now, it's quite extraordinary to think that private companies are the ones who are now trying to have the growth in nuclear power. But again, Ireland is a bit different in that regard. We actually have laws against the generation of nuclear energy on this island. I mean, would you be confident that, for all the talk that it's environmentally the best way to produce power because there are no carbon emissions, zero carbon emissions, and even though you can recycle the uranium waste and all the rest of it, many people are deeply fearful of something going wrong in the nuclear process.
It's certainly a complicated area, and I can understand people's fears with it. I mean, you know, we're our preference, and I think most of the tech companies' preference, is to use renewables to power this AI revolution. Where there is a gap there, we have to look at other alternatives. And that's why you're seeing, I think you're referring to the Three Mile Island.
Which was one of the most infamous nuclear meltdowns in global history.
It was a specific set of circumstances.
Back in the 1970s.
A specific set of circumstances a long time ago. And of course, the technology has come on significantly since then. That's notwithstanding some of the incidents that have happened globally, of course. But on balance, I mean, you're right that nuclear power is an emissions-free energy. It's certainly not renewable per se, but it's emissions-free. There's a lot of nuclear energy gets generated across Europe. I think it's something like 50 to two-thirds of all of the energy produced in France comes from nuclear power, right? I don't think we've any plans to build any nuclear power stations anytime soon here in Ireland. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see more broadly what the EU does in terms of this space and maybe some normalization or harmonization of power generation rules across the EU. And, you know, you need to look at where the government's pointing to in this direction in the future. What's the Celtic Interconnector going to bring, right, into, you know, in terms of getting electricity from mainland Europe and giving...
It'll be nuclear generated, but...
Well, it could be, right? Yeah. Who knows, right? But look, these things will change over time.
You mentioned the EU. What about EU regulations in relation to AI and generative AI? How do they compare what's going to happen in the United States and other parts of the world? And by being part of the EU, could we find here in Ireland that we are going to perhaps be behind other areas?
Well, I suppose I would say from the outset, there's no shortage of EU regulations around at the moment, or indeed for the foreseeable future. I'll maybe come back to that point in a moment. But specifically with regard to regulation on AI, you know, Microsoft has been very supportive of the AI Act, which came into force earlier this year. And really, I suppose the guiding principles around the AI Act are very well aligned with the risk-based approach that we have been promoting as far back as 2018. So in 2018, we set out a number of AI principles based on fairness, accountability, transparency, inclusivity, safety and security, privacy and reliability. And you see all of that reflected really in the AI Act. You see it reflected in terms of, I mean, maybe you remember, I don't know, but back in 2018, 2019, the European Commission's high-level expert group on AI, which is co-chaired, I think, by Barry O'Sullivan from Cork, came up with a set of recommendations that map very closely to our own view around it. So Microsoft welcomes the AI Act and the risk-based approach that it takes, the classification of high risk, you know, unacceptable, low risk, medium risk. That's the way that we operate with our own guidelines for the products that we build internally and the way that we advise our customers to work. So we're very much supportive of that. I think Europe has always been at the head of the curve in terms of global regulation. But it's complicated. You know, it's going to be complicated and burdensome and expensive for organizations to get their head around, just as it's been complicated for organizations to get their head around GDPR, for example, right?
You mentioned at the outset about how you've worked a lot with the public sector as part of your job at Microsoft.
Yes.
Is the public sector as willing and able and speedily to do so, to engage with AI, as perhaps private sector companies do?
So it's a great question. Traditionally, the answer to that would be the public sector has always been a little bit behind and private sector has been a little bit more aggressive in terms of adoption. But we're seeing great signs of interest and adoption of AI within public sector. You know, obviously, both globally and in Ireland as well, we're seeing a lot of opportunities, specifically in Ireland as well, in terms of revamping the types of services that the public sector offers to citizens. So, you know, for the last number of years, we've talked about digitally transforming these citizens so that you can do things like applying for your passport online, for example, right? And what we're seeing now is a statement of intent by the public sector, by government. Of course, it's had its AI strategy out for quite some time, But and there's a specific section in that strategy that talks about ensuring public sector is adopting AI. And we're starting to see that. We're seeing examples of the public sector looking to use AI technology to make citizen services easier to use and easier to consume. And we've actually worked with the government on a number of projects, some pilot projects as well, with the Department of Enterprise, Trade and Employment on providing an AI-based system for access for small businesses to information about small business supports and grants. So, you know, this is not a step change function. It's gradual, as it is right across the industry. But interestingly, we're seeing all public sector and the Irish public sector acknowledging and accepting we need to get on the train here, and we're seeing a lot of good signs there.
Yeah, but could it be transformational for something like our health service, for example, if there was a willingness to actually embrace it? Because the fear will be amongst a lot of people that, oh, it's going to cost jobs. But is there actually a reasonable trade-off to be made that maybe, yes, it would cost some administrative jobs, but by God, it could transform the delivery of health services in Ireland?
I think you're right. Mostly, right? I don't think it's going to cost really any jobs in the short term, to be honest. I don't actually think it's going to even cost administrative jobs. When you look at using AI, I gave that e-bike example that I had tipped to Kathleen from earlier. There's a great opportunity in health. I think any function or any organization that has huge amounts of data to deal with can benefit from the use of AI, and specifically when you've got data in the health service that's not strictly numeric. You might have patient notes and doctor observations or other clinician observations. Being able to derive insights from that can improve outcomes for patients and improve the speed of the delivery of services. So, you know, we have a company that Microsoft owns called Nuance. They showed just a couple of weeks ago some new functionality that they're able to provide, which is essentially a generative AI agent that can sit in the middle of a consult between a practitioner and a patient. And the practitioner might say, you know, Matt, we've had a look at these tests and we think you're going to need a biopsy and you might need an x-ray. And the agent just, it picks this up in the conversation, speech conversation, and can automatically go and schedule those appointments, can book an appointment for you for an x-ray or an MRI. I mean, all of this is possible. It's just there's the willingness that needs to be put in place to make it happen.
To conclude this interview in this section of the fourth episode of AI Magnified, what would your summation be of where you think we're going with all of this?
I don't even know how to answer that question. We're going upwards and we're going at pace. I think what, you know, my view is that I've been just amazed at the rapid pace of development.
Yeah, I get a sense of excitement from you.
I've never been as excited in the 35 years as I have over the last 18 months. It's a fascinating area to work in. I think it really is going to advance at pace. I think, you know, if you look back just in terms of what OpenAI has been able to do, you know, when ChatGPT hit the streets back in, when was it, November 22, you could ask it questions with a keyboard and you could get responses coming back. And, you know, not too long after that, you can take a picture and you can ask it to give information about the picture. It's now fully multimodal. You know, you basically can turn the camera on and it can analyze what's happening and it can give you insights in terms of information in relation to that. I think it's only going to become much more sophisticated, much more prevalent in every aspect of our lives. And that's important and brings a lot of value, but also needs to be controlled, which is why I think that, you know, as this rapid advancement in the technology takes place, this almost ambient artificial intelligence that's all around us, aware of what we're doing and providing valuable recommendations and insights and commentary on that, we need to make sure we've got the right responsible AI controls in place to make sure it's done properly.
Kieran McCorry, thank you so much for joining us on this edition of AI Magnified. Just to remind you again about the special AI Magnified panel event in association with Fitzgerald Power and AIB on the 14th of November. If you're interested in attending, fitzgeraldpower.ie/ AI event is where you need to go to find out more about the event and how you can attend. Now, coming up in the next part of this special edition, we are going to talk to Fergal O'Rourke, who is the chairman of IDEA Ireland, about how government and the state is preparing for all of this. Fergal, as chairman of IDEA Ireland, how much attention is the organisation paying to artificial intelligence and generative artificial intelligence and where it is going to bring the economy and Ireland's part in the global economy?
Well, at the moment, the IDEA is going through its five-year strategic review, which hopefully will be finalised and given to government by the end of the year. But it's no secret to say that Michael Lohan, the chief executive, and his team have a huge focus on AI. And for those of a certain age, I mean, this is sort of equivalent to the emergence of the internet, or I go back further than you, Matt, to the advent of personal computers. It is, as I would see it, almost the third wave of industrial revolution in my time. So it's going to be massive. And, you know, in a sense, I see it almost stratified into four areas. You've got the AI companies themselves, like OpenAI, for example. You've got the companies supplying then into artificial intelligence companies like NVIDIA, for example, making the chips that power them. You've got companies who will be building AI into their offerings, whether it's IBM or Google or Meta or all the Amazon, all the other companies. And finally, you have every other single company who in some shape or form will be seeing, can AI transform their business? And this is what we're finding at the moment, that the challenge every foreign company has been given from headquarters is, can you transform yourself? Can you digitally upskill your people? Can you transform your business to become net zero? And can you incorporate artificial intelligence into making your operations better, quicker, faster, smarter? And that's where we're finding a lot of really interesting projects coming to the IDEA looking for assistance. And I suppose it's in Ireland's interests to make sure that the companies here stay as relevant back at HQ as possible.
And that sort of brings us to that third of the four pillars that you identified there. A lot of the companies you mentioned have significant interests here in Ireland. Mm. But how are we going to ensure that they continue the investment in Ireland into AI rather than bringing that investment to other locations?
Yeah, and I mean, already in calendar 2024, and obviously I can't talk about individual names, but there's been some really fantastic projects that have crossed the executive and the board desks in relation to AI in Ireland. And we're probably coming from a position of strength because a lot of these companies here have substantial operations. And one of the things over my career, I've worked in the foreign direct investment area for almost all of my professional life, Irish country managers of foreign multinationals excel at making themselves relevant back at headquarters. Unlike other countries, what Irish country managers do very well is they build strong relationships at headquarters, they understand the roadmap that the company is going on globally, and they're able to say, okay, in 2 years' time, we want to position the Irish operation to make sure we get in that investment pattern, that investment wave. So as well as the fact that they have substance here and a track record, two-thirds of all new investment in Ireland comes from existing companies here already. So Ireland works for these companies. Back at headquarters, they have a positive view. You've also then got the Irish country leadership team saying, let's get the AI operations here. So this isn't a case of IDEA carrying all the water. It's a case of the IDEA working in partnership with the local multinational team to say, okay, what's the best way of positioning this operation to get the next AI investment? And it is paying off. We've seen a couple of public announcements already, and there will be more announcements over the coming months. So certainly as an organization, we want our unfair share of global AI investment, but we're doing quite well at the moment.
Now, I did a lot of reading prior to this interview, and then I had an idea this morning. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to ask ChatGPT answer a question for me, right? And the question I put to it, because I have my own ideas in relation to this, which I'll be putting to you, but I asked ChatGPT, what are the issues facing Ireland that might limit or discourage future foreign direct investment? And of course, it's back to me literally within seconds, which is the extraordinary thing, right? So Ireland faces several challenges that could potentially limit or discourage foreign future further foreign direct investment. They listed some of them, actually the order in which they came are not necessarily relevant to this discussion. One was high operating costs. Mm. Second, skilled labour shortages, which could be relevant in relation to AI. Third, infrastructure deficiencies, which I definitely had intended talking to you about. The fourth one it came, and actually there is full explanations behind each of these headlines. I'm just not going to read them out for you now. Geopolitical and economic pressures. Then the fifth one, interesting, regulatory environment. And the sixth one, energy supply concerns, which I wouldn't have had number six. I'd have had that up earlier. And then I asked another question. I said, is government doing enough to encourage AI investment, or is Ireland doing enough? And it said, Ireland has been actively working to encourage AI investment through various initiatives and policies. Here are some key efforts. Number one, government support and funding. And it mentioned IDA Ireland within that. Second, educational initiatives. Third, research and innovation hubs, such as the Insight Centre for Data Analytics and the ADAPT Centre, and a favourable business environment, and it mentioned strategic partnerships and regulatory framework. And then the kicker, though, at the end was, while these efforts are significant, there are always areas for improvement, such as further enhancing infrastructure, addressing data privacy concerns, and ensuring continuous upskilling of the workforce to keep pace with rapid technological advancements. And what really struck me reading this is, now this is editorializing on the part of ChatGPT. It's not as we would have had in the past if you did a Google search or whatever.
Correct.
And you'd have found articles that you interpret for yourself. This is artificial intelligence actually making an assessment and presenting it to you as if it's fact.
And it's interesting, and I think it shows both the power and limitations of ChatGPT, because the power is, if you had got some researcher or I'd got some researcher to write that up, it might have taken them, you know, a few hours. You got it there in seconds.
Yeah.
And yet it still needs some human interaction there to say, well, actually, that's not quite the order I'd have them in, or that's not quite the emphasis I would have had. But in that single chat, you've shown the power and the limitations so far of artificial intelligence and particularly ChatGPT.
Does that scare you? Given that we're both men of a roughly similar
yes.
age.
Well, I'm a bit older, I think, Matt.
Older than me, but you know, that, okay, maybe we're coming towards the end of careers. Hopefully not. Mm. There's a good few years left for both of us. But that the pace of this change is going to be exceptionally challenging for our children and their children.
Yeah, although I remember, Matt, I joined the workforce in 1986, just as personal computers were taking off portable computers. Now, portable, you need to be Arnold Schwarzenegger to actually carry these things. But I remember at the time, where I grew up professionally in Pricewaterhouse, we had a group of predominantly females called comptometers. And their job, day in, day out, was to tot numbers. Literally, they would get rolls and rolls of numbers they would have to tot. And I remember when, as part of the audit process, and they would have literally these machines for totting on. And when personal computers came in, that group almost disappeared overnight. But then, I remember people saying, gosh, you know, doing tax computations now would be so much quicker, so much easier. We won't need as many people. You know what? We needed twice as many people because the world expanded. Different jobs came into vogue. So there's no doubt that a bit like the car replacing the horse, there will be jobs that in 10 years' time we will look back on and say, gosh, you know, where have those jobs gone? But there will be jobs that we can't comprehend now or don't comprehend of that will be in existence in 10 years' time. I'm an optimist by nature. I think the opportunities will still be there for Ireland. In the same ways that in the late 90s, if you had said, what jobs will Ireland really have in the 21st century? Nobody at that point had heard of Meta or Google or Amazon was just taking off. Or, you know, so there will be threats, absolutely. But time and time again, we've proved nimble and agile. And I want to come back to that because we need to be even more nimble and more agile these days. But I think there'll be positives. And once we're not complacent, and I would have a paranoia about complacency. I think once people get the time to really worry is when everybody is saying, ah, it's all fine, it's all fine. And I don't think Ireland is complacent right now. And I deliberately pick that word because complacent has this sense of we're all fine. I think everybody in the system knows there are challenges ahead, but the system isn't as nimble and agile as it used to be. It's not complacency. It's almost a problem of success that we're not able to move as quickly and fast to make sure the system responds quickly. That's what we need to improve over the next while.
I'm fascinated that you use complacency as a word I've been using actually recently in relation to this, because my fear would be that things are happening so quickly in relation to generative AI and the amount of money that's being invested by many of the companies who are already present in Ireland and by other companies who have a smaller footprint in Ireland or none at all. It's going in very quickly and they know where they want to spend the money, and that we are being slow and complacent in actually having the infrastructure in place for them. And particularly I want to ask you about data centres, because it is quite clear that data centres are central to the processing of AI. We had enormous opportunity here in Ireland because of our temperate climate as a great location for these data centres, one of the very best places in the world. And if you look at it on a global environmental basis, better to have these data centres in Ireland than many other places because less emissions. And what are we doing? We're actually, because of a failure to expand our grid here in Ireland, we effectively have a ban on new data centres, which means we could miss out on what needs to be done in AI.
Yeah, and you know, anytime you see an article or a commentary on data centres, it's almost as if there's a war between two competing ideologies about data centres. And I disagree with that premise, because if I can expand a bit on, there's so much that the system is in agreement on. Everybody agrees that data centres are a critical part of the digital infrastructure. And indeed, Minister Eamon Ryan is also on record as emphasising the importance of data centres. They create employment, about 30,000 people. They're part of the corporation tax flow that is paying for the economy. Everybody agrees that data centres, therefore, in of themselves are a good thing. Everybody agrees that if we can execute on our plans for both offshore energy and the grid, that come 2030, 2031, this issue will not exist of data centres consuming too much energy. So we're all agreed on that. And the only thing at the moment where that disagreement arises, and you may have read Michael Lohan and the IDA did a really good submission to the Commission for
Energy Regulation
and Utilities. And basically, the two things that we in IDA are looking for is certainty on the roadmap. And secondly, you know, there, and it comes down to timing. There's a group of people that want data centres to be net zero from inception. In IDEA, we're saying we want a reasonable time frame to allow those data centres to get. And, you know, there's a consultation process going on at the moment that IDEA would have contributed last August. And I see that as a positive, because if you go back 6 or 8 months, there was talk of no consultative process. So now it's there. So it comes down, ultimately, the only difference that's out there in the system is around timing. And people, you know, some people put forward the proposition it's the economy or the environment. It's the economy and the environment, because ultimately we need to generate revenues to pay for what would be a very expensive transition. And the last thing we want is to lose on both fronts. We've lost the economic chance to transform Ireland from an environmental perspective, and we've lost gaining ground on the steep targets we've got to meet in climate. So I'd be calling for a practical view of the next 4 or 5 years that gives data centre certainty and is realistic about the transition process over that period.
I think the complacency issue that I want to bring up is in relation to, you've already touched on it there, the potential for losing the corporation tax revenue upon which we have become so dependent if we don't support these companies. But I'm fascinated by what you say in that there seems to be general agreement about what we need to do. I agree with you on that. My problem is with implementation.
Yeah.
That we talk about what we need. We understand what we need. We know what we need to do. And yet everything gets tied up apparently in inertia and red tape. And the potential for not just supplying more than enough energy for these data centres, but enough energy for the country to actually export, has been lost by a failure to deliver and all the things that we need, that we know we need to do.
And that's a fair comment. And I mean, in fact, the only thing I disagree with there, Matt, I'd hate if we were in a position that we were exporting power. I think that would be akin in the 50s to exporting cattle on the hoof, where the value added has been exported somewhere else. I think what we in IDEA certainly will be doing over the next couple of years, as the grid capacity grows and as the offshore energy availability rises, we should be going to large energy users and saying, come to Ireland, because we've got this surplus green energy. But to your point, you're exactly right. When I had to appear before the Oireachtas when I was appointed earlier in the year as chairman of IDEA, I identified execution risk as the big risk facing Ireland. And to go back to my point about complacency, I've met nobody in the system who thinks everything is fine, we don't need to worry, sure, the money is rolling in. I've met nobody with that approach. We have great plans, but the single biggest barrier to getting where we want to get to over the next 5 years is executing on those plans. On an areas like planning, we need to sharpen up, and hopefully, you know, with changes in the planning legislation, that will help. But it also needs big, bold moves, I think. You know, it's not a controversial statement to say that this government is in its final days. There are no more budgets. It's only a question, as my late mother used to ask, is it November or February?
And by the time that this goes to air, we might know the election.
Who knows? But I think the challenge for the next government is actually to almost create a sense of urgency and unity of purpose about what Ireland wants to be over the next decade. And if you look at the great things that have been done in Ireland, whether it's free education or the establishment of the IFSC, it was a whole of government approach. And we can do it, Matt. If you go back to COVID, where suddenly the country shut down, over a weekend in the Department of Finance, Pascal Dunne, who was then Minister of Finance, John Hogan, the Secretary General of the Department of Finance, Niall Cody, the Chairman of the Revenue Commissioners, and a few of their officials got into a room for 2 or 3 days. And over that 2 or 3 days period, they came up with the whole, payments to keep people in employment, et cetera, et cetera. In a space of a week, the system turned on its head and brought in a whole programme to keep Ireland going during COVID. So it can be done. And I think a new government, I would be saying, you know, take a vision for the next 10 years of where we want Ireland to be, and let's go for it.
Funny enough, in a previous edition of Magnified in the main series, the man who's now the mayor of Limerick, John Moran,
yes,
spoke about that particular period as one of two outstanding successes, that and when the state faced near liquidation as a result of the crash in 2008, as when the system reacted and dealt. But he said that for crises like housing and other things, we don't move quickly enough or give it enough priority.
We need to create that sense of crisis.
But you see, then that raises the interesting thing for me, in that you've identified about how everyone in the system knows what we have to do. But is there the political will to implement it? And I'm not going to ask you to be in any way political in relation to this, but is there a lot of time that there's an easy cop-out and that politicians will say, well, yeah, we know we need data centres, but not one in my local constituency? And
we lose out.
We have lost out already because of objections to much-needed infrastructure that actually does handicap the country.
Yeah, and I have a hope and a belief that a new government of whatever hue it is has money in the bank from the Apple judgment and the surpluses, has a roadmap on where it needs to go. If you talk to Airgrid, if you talk to Irish Water, if you talk to Gas Networks Ireland, ESB, the plan is there. I think what's needed now, and you know yourselves, Matt, in the early period of a government, it is the chance to make things happen and get things going. So I'm hoping that a new government will really seize that moment to create that vision.
Do you think politicians understand fully what AI is all about, and particularly generative AI, and how it is all changing?
Oh, one politician told me recently that he was doing a speech on something and he literally typed in the topics he wanted to discuss and out came this ready-made speech. I think they do at a very
superficial level.
Not a superficial level, but in fairness, at an immediate relevancy level, they do. And I think they do. I mean, I always talk into companies and an idea. We always encourage companies to talk to politicians, to bring them around their organisations, to tell them what's going on. And since becoming chairman, the number of companies I visited, it would blow your mind the sort of things they're doing. Not just like in manufacturing, in advanced manufacturing, in AI. the level of innovation, I mean, it used to bug me when I worked in my previous life, how people would say, oh, companies are only here for the tax and da-da-da. Rubbish. I mean, when you see the skill level of Irish people and indeed people coming into Ireland to work on these things, it's absolutely fantastic. I think politicians do get it because in every county, in every major town in Ireland, there is some foreign direct investment company and they're doing something innovative.
And indeed, they also have lots of people who've come from outside of Ireland
Correct.
To work with these companies.
Yeah.
Which brings me back to one of the other points that came up in that little search that I did in ChatGPT, labour shortages and education. In how much of a concern would you have that maybe, again, that we won't be able to get the AI investment if we don't have the people in the country and if our own people haven't actually skilled up sufficiently to be able to deal with AI?
It's funny, compared to when I would have joined the workforce in the late 80s, this is a problem of success we have, not a problem of failure. Back in the 80s, the issue would have been we've plenty of people available for employment that weren't skilled enough. I think the issue now is actually we have virtually full employment. We have 2.77 million people at work, the highest number ever in the history of the state. So the issue is not that our people aren't skilled. The issue is nearly we don't have enough people, full stop. So the continued migration of high-skilled labour is essential to the continued growth of Ireland. And when I talk to companies, it's rare they would say we can't get good people. Sorry, that the level and quality of people in Ireland aren't good. They would say the Irish people tend to do exceptionally well in their organisations, both at a technical level and a strategic level. The issue is, can you get me another 200 software engineers? So it's not, they're not bemoaning the quality of the output from the Irish institutions. They're bemoaning the fact that why don't you have a population twice the size, because we could put twice the business through Ireland that we currently do.
But do we still need to invest more in particularly third level education?
Yes.
And have the engineers and all the various people who work in these areas?
Yes. And you know that if you had Orla Feeney from UCD or any of the other heads in here, they would say, of course, if they had more money, they could do more. And it's great to see that public-private partnership, say what the Collison brothers have done down in UL in creating new relevant courses for the 21st century. So this is one of those things. Are we bad at it? No. Would I like to see more of it? And even more and more again, yes, I absolutely would. But it's not the issue that first comes to mind when you're chatting to companies about, you know, and the question I will always ask is, you know, what works well from an Irish perspective and what would you like to see Ireland improve on? And infrastructure tends to be one of the first ones that comes up.
Our membership of the European Union is also, yeah, critical, but isn't necessarily in a positive way. And let me just put it to you this sense that there's an enormous amount of concern internationally about regulation of artificial intelligence. And the Americans are struggling with this at a national level, federal level, but also with the likes of California as to how to do this. Europe is perhaps a bit tougher in relation to how it might actually regulate artificial intelligence. So Britain, on the other hand, is making a major push to attract investment in AI. So could it be that we actually are in danger of losing out to the UK because our membership of the EU means that we might have regulation that is less attractive to foreign companies coming to Ireland?
Yeah, and I mean, one perennial criticism of the EU is that, you know, people, critics will say that in Europe we regulate first and innovate second, whereas in America they innovate first and regulate second. And that has been a fair criticism, and the recent Draghi report would have brought that out as well. But if you look at Matt sitting on Governor Gavin Newsom's desk at the moment, passed by the Californian Assembly, is a bill to regulate AI. And he, that one single man, will have the power to effectively shape the regulation of AI. Because if California does regulate AI, that really will be a game changer for the rest of the world. And I read recently that, you know, he could veto the bill, in which case it would require a two-thirds assembly majority to overturn that, which hasn't happened since 1980. But I think everybody is watching Gavin Newsom now to see what will he do on this bill. And if he does that, Europe will now be leading the way on regulating AI. And I think we'll set the standards for others. So great. I'm not particularly worried at this very point, because if California goes ahead, that will set the global standard.
We keep talking about the technology companies, but it does strike me as well that many other companies are going to be using AI and investing heavily in AI. We have an enormous pharmaceutical sector here in Ireland. How important do you anticipate AI being to them?
There was a brilliant article in the New Yorker magazine there in the last 6 or 8 weeks about the creation of new drugs and how artificial intelligence is effectively transforming the process of that. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think pharmaceuticals will be one of those areas that will hugely benefit. I think there's going to be a huge slew of new drugs coming on over the next couple of years. And I think, again, going back to why does Ireland do so well? Ireland works. We now have an ecosystem for pharmaceutical companies here that's well-tried, well-trusted. They can get the right people. They can build the right plants. There's a well-regulated, understood system here. So in a sense, I think... pharmaceuticals could go through a golden era in the coming years as more and more potentially blockbuster drugs. I think the pipeline is going to get a lot more sharper. There'll be a lot less winnowing out to get to the new drugs. If there's a whole slew of new drugs coming on, I think Ireland could be in a great position to actually win those mandates for those pharmaceutical companies to produce them here.
And we always talk about the tech sector and the pharmaceutical sector as being the drivers of our corporation tax revenue. But you've mentioned a couple of times the 1980s. Remember the impact of the Financial Services Centre when it was set up? And it still has an impact, financial services. So again, do you think, is Ireland doing enough to facilitate the transition in financial services to the use of AI?
Yes, it is. And in fact, you know, Brexit actually was a great boon to the IFSC and the wider financial services sector in Ireland. The track record will help us there. Are companies really working hard now to implement AI? Yes. And going back to where we kind of started in this discussions, every single company in Ireland, domestic or foreign, is actually looking at their business and say, how can we use AI to make it better, quicker, faster, smarter, and taking those steps. And organisations like Enterprise Ireland and IDA, we're there shoulder to shoulder with them to make sure they can make those changes.
Okay, coming towards the conclusion of this, and we've done a series and we have a conference coming up as well, and we're going to have details for people who are listening to this and watching this as to how, if they wanted to attend the conference. How positive do you think we should be at this stage? I mean, I know there's opportunities involved in AI, but how positive do you think we should be about that this is going to be for the good of the Irish economy?
We can't put our head in the sand and think, oh, this is going to go away and sure, you know, we don't need to worry. I think we need to be paranoid about it. But we have a good track record when the internet came along, when personal computers came along. We made sure we reorientated the economy. If I go back to when I was a child, the big employer in Athlone was a company called Gentex, a textile manufacturing company. That was finished by the late 70s, early 80s. Then Elan came along, the pharmaceutical company. We just need to make sure that both for indigenous industry and for foreign direct investment, we are, I call it the four I's. I've been an ex-consultant. I, you have to have something which is catchy. We need to double down on infrastructure and really, really quickly. We need to start rebuilding our influence. Recently, I read an article that Catherine Day, who you remember, who's the most senior civil servant in the EU, there's no next generation Irish Catherine Day coming through Europe. We need to go back and start building our network in Europe and on Wall Street and on K Street in Washington. We need to start incentivizing again. I think post-Apple, I think the government felt, let's keep our head down now when it comes to tax incentives. For both indigenous industry and for foreign direct investment, we need to get back into the tax incentive game in a legal, fair, competitive way. What can we do to have companies saying, gosh, let's look at Ireland again? And the last thing is innovation, where the real skills growth over the next 5 and 10 years are going to be research, development, innovation, artificial intelligence. You know, I think the state is, through IDA and Enterprise Ireland, orientating its focus on that area. So I personally believe in 5 or 6 years' time, if the grid has been upgraded, the water system has been upgraded, if we have now, instead of the 6.5 gigawatts we currently produce, we have 14 or 15, mostly coming in from offshore wind energy. We have helped all the companies here, local and foreign, to move up the value chain. I think the best days of Ireland in relation to economic development are ahead of us. A surplus of energy, very attractive to part of a wider European community still, attractive to heavy energy users. I think if we get it right, and I place a lot of emphasis on those words, if we get it right, the 2030s could be another golden era for economic achievement in Ireland.
That's a great way to finish.
Thank you.
Dr. Lurie, Chairman of AD Ireland, thank you. And that's it for this episode of AI Magnified. Thank you to my guests. And if you enjoyed our discussion about AI, then please join us for a special AI Magnified panel event in association with Fitzgerald Power and AIB on the 14th of November, where you can hear from SME leaders and how AI is transforming business operations. You can register your interest at fitzgeraldpower.ie/AI event. This series proudly sponsored by Fitzgerald Power. More than just accountants, Fitzgerald Power is a trusted partner for its clients. The firm is committed to empowering businesses with deeper financial insights, helping them make strategic, informed decisions.
AI Magnified, brought to you by Go Loud and proudly sponsored by Fitzgerald Power. Adding value always. FitzgeraldPower.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.